We're live this hour with a couple of guests who are local historians or history buffs. We're going to find out exactly what their connection is in this hour of history. We have Catherine Cassidy and Carol Knutson in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I spoke with them on the phone here in the last week setting this up. And they came in and they sat down here in the studio. And it occurred to me that I didn't know which was which. And so I had to ask them. And now that I have it straight, we could jump right in. First, why don't you folks tell our listeners and me just a little bit how you got into the history of where we live.
Yeah? Oh, Catherine? Thanks. This is Catherine Cassidy. I live in Kisilov. I've lived in Kisilov since 1987. And I'm very active with the Kisilov Regional Historical Association, and I love history. It wasn't something that I was always enamored with. But when I moved here, I was working, my first job was working down on the Kisilov River for what was then Cook Inlet Processing, a buying station for commercial salmon fishermen on the Kisilov River. And there were some old sort of ruins isn't the quite word, but there was some old evidence of a cannery that had been there built originally in the 1880s, in 1882. It was the second operational cannery to be built in Alaska and the first one in South Central. And I learned about this a couple years after I started working there. Alan Boris and Penny McLean put on a photo display at the Kenai Peninsula College of photographs that had been taken of that cannery back around 1890. And I became hooked on local history at that time. Later, with Gary Titus, a local historian, put together a biography on a man named Andrew Berg, who had come to the Cook Inlet to work for that cannery in 1888 and ended up spending his life here. And he left a journal and all sorts of things. And we put together a biography of him, and that further sucked me into the local history, particularly of the Kisilov area.
I can't wait to ask you about that fella. Well, how about you, Carol?
Well, my parents homesteaded near Kisilov in 1958. We moved down here from Anchorage. And the rest of the peninsula has a much more extensive history than the Soldotna area does. And so Soldotna was pretty much brand new when we came. We came about 10 years after the very first settlers, the original homesteaders in 1947, came to Soldotna. And so it occurred to me that basically the entire history of the Soldotna area has happened in my lifetime. And so when I was thinking of history in my immediate area, I was talking to the principal people that did this. It wasn't like just picking up a history book and learning about somebody 100 years before my time. It was very much the now, and but basically it was my mom who got me involved, because she was in with the beginning of the Soldotna Historical Society's museum, the Homestead Museum that they built there just above Centennial Park. And so she used to volunteer as a docent there. And when I came back to Alaska in 2000 to help mom so she could stay on the homestead, she said, I want you to do this. When you retire, I want you to take over this. And so now that's what I do every summer. I'm the docent at the Soldotna Historical Society. But beyond that, I had a wonderful, really wonderful teacher of Alaska history when I went to college. I went to college in Anchorage at Alaska Methodist University that later turned into APU. And his name was Frank Brink. And he just brought it all alive to me. And so I thought it was kind of interesting that Alaska has the kind of history that can go back to practically prehistoric time, but also it's what's happening right now. We are the history of the Kenai Peninsula, and that's why I got interested.
Oh, man. Yeah. I love history, too, and for kind of the same reason. I had, like, the best teachers in, starting in fifth grade. I remember exactly when I got hooked. It was my fifth grade teacher, Mrs. Atkinson, and she just made classical history come alive. I still read about it just for fun. And then, it expanded from there. I love history of all kinds. And do you folks go to the Alaska Historical Society conventions and such? I went to a couple.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no? I don't, generally.
They're a lot of fun in conjunction with the Museums Alaska. Oh,
yes.
Yeah. Have attended, and there are great resources available to us. But it's just hard to fit in. This is just a hobby and a volunteer activity, and it's hard to fit in everything that all the opportunities that are out there.
Right. Catherine, I wanted to ask you about this. You mentioned you came up and worked in the cannery. I find so many people. I want to know if you find this to be true. I find so many people come up, and I don't know if it's just because salmon is the reason so many people come to Alaska, but I find that salmon really is the hook that keeps people in Alaska, just the interest in everything around it, and then it just grows from there.
Definitely, and it's been true for the immigrants, the Euro-Americans, since Alaska was first discovered. Well, no, that wasn't true. The Russians were coming for the sea mammals. Mm-hmm. But then I have to say, for me, family members had come up and worked in commercial fishing, and that's what I did. I wasn't intending to work in the fishing industry when I got here. I had worked in healthcare and human services, but I loved it. I just discovered it's a because of this extraordinary resource we have, the opportunity to become a part of the food production service industry for feeding the world was just amazing. And I think that was probably true back for the Scandinavian immigrants who were coming up to work in Kisilov in the 1890s.
Yeah, absolutely. Carol, did you ever work in the cannery or on the beach, sitting outside?
It's hard to grow up in Alaska without spending at least one summer working the slime line. when we came, there were three big working canneries at the mouth of the Kenai River, and there were two more at the mouth of the Kisilov River, and there was another one at Clam Gulch, and there was a couple at Anchor Point, and then they were down at Homer and across. And so it was... A lot of people came up every year as a temporary thing, but for us Alaskan kids, it was sort of one of the rites of passage. You had to be 16 to work in the cannery, and my kid brother, Casey, was 14, and so he knew he couldn't come over to the cannery in Kenai, so he hitchhiked down to Clam Gulch to see if he couldn't get a job at the little cannery there that was run by Per Osmer. And Per knew that Casey was not 16 years old, although he didn't ask. So he gave him a job putting together the cardboard boxes that the cans would go in. So technically he wasn't working in the cannery. But my mom used to say that the real benefit of the cannery for local kids was you spend a summer working a slime line and it gives you enough motivation to get all the way through school.
That's true. I had a similar experience when I was 15. I grew up in Dillingham, and the cannery there, Peter Pan, you could be 14 and work in the egg house. So all the ninth and 10th graders would work there. And some kids right out of eighth grade, I guess. So I went down there when I was 15. Actually, I was 14, about to be 15, thinking I was going to get a job in the egg house. But I was 6 feet tall, and I had like a little mustache, you know, and they did not ask me how old I was. I walked in with my older cousin, who was smaller than me, and they put me to work on the can line. They put me to work driving forklifts. They
don't ask, don't tell.
Yeah, everything. I was. They had me on the roof of the cannery with the carpenters.
Yeah,
I was 15 years old.
We didn't have OSHA then.
Yeah, boy, I tell you, and yeah, it was crazy. But it was a fun summer. I think back on it, and I certainly wouldn't have put a 15-year-old in the forklift. I was lifting other guys up onto the roof, you know, riding wheelies on it. Yeah, just guy things, I guess. You know, we before we went on the air, we heard a little story about when you moved down here from Anchorage, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Could you relate that to us?
Well, I had heard about the possibility of homestead since the beginning of time. Probably one of my earliest memories was my mom talking about wanting to homestead. And for one reason after another, it got put off and it got put off. And so by the time I was 15 years old, I had quit worrying about it. It was just mom's pipe dream and it wasn't going to happen until she came home. And I came home one day and she's strapping a equipment onto the back of an old flatbed truck, and she said, I'm going, and anybody that wants to come can, and if you don't, you can stay here, but we're going to the homestead. And I was appalled. And so we came to the homestead. This was back in the days when the Sterling Highway was just a dirt road, and there really wasn't anything much here. There were 1 through 8 grades at Kosilov at a one-room schoolhouse, but there was no high school. We had to come to Kenai for school, which was a 25-mile drive then. So I wasn't very much in favor, but the worst problem was that there were no telephones down here. It wasn't just that there wasn't a telephone on the homestead. Nobody had telephones except the businesses here in Kenai and a very few in Soldotna. And I was just sure that my life was over. There was no telephone. But I found out that doesn't necessarily mean to be true. And there were, one of the wonderful things about the Kenai, in these small communities all over the Kenai Peninsula, they, even then when they were much smaller, there was a very strong sense of community, and there were lots of things going on. People think you live in the wilderness, there's nothing happening, but there was little theater that almost everybody was involved in. There was ham operators. There was the Civil Air Patrol. There were Saturday night dances. They would just pull the fire truck out of the fire hall in Kenai and scatter some cornmeal on the floor and call it done and put on records on a record player and everybody would dance. And so it turned out to be a perfectly fine thing, but at the time I was not very enthusiastic about it.
Oh, boy. Now, I agree with you 100%. There used to be things to do. You know, when there weren't many people and there wasn't much stuff, there was always things to do. And now that there's all this other stuff, it's like nobody has anything to do or time to do nothing.
That's
right.
That's it. Those things still take place here. But the day-to-day life is so much more complicated today than it was in the 1950s down here that people don't take advantage of it. And one of the things are every community on the Kenai has got a historical society. A lot of people don't even know. I mean, I hear people all summer long, people from the area instead of tourists that come to the museum because they've got visitors from out of state who has said, what about your museum? And the people that live here didn't even know it was there. And so there's still plenty to do here, but you have to look for it. And back then you didn't.
Right.
I love Carol's perspective on moving to the wilds of Soldotnicka Selof as a 15-year-old. But now let's back it up. Let's see how many years. Back to the turn of the last century, and the people who were settling in the area had a whole lot less to do than we can even imagine. The traffic would shut down on Cook Inlet in the winter. I mean, shut down. If you had a medical problem, your best option for getting help, beginning in the 1910s, 1920s, when Seward had developed into a real town, you could get medical help by getting on a dog sled and going up to Cooper Landing and across Kenai Lake and catching the railroad right away. There typically weren't even trains running in the winter in those days, but you could travel down the railroad right away to Seward and get some kind of medical care in the winter. In the summer, you'd take a boat to Seldovia or Kodiak. There were no banks, there were no grocery stores. The cannery would haul up supplies and sell a few groceries. You were seriously isolated in this side of, in this part of Cook Inlet.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's amazing how much more accessible we get every year, really.
Yeah, it is. It's astounding. And that's one thing I love about it. It's a game I play in my mind. Well, yeah, so I'm complaining about such and such, you know, gosh, the Kasilov post office closes for an hour for lunch every day and how inconvenient that is. Goodness. Well, it's really nice to have a post office. The small things. And the telephone that you're talking about, the phones, Carol, I have to hand it to the early homesteaders in Kasilov. There were half a dozen, eight fox farming homesteads that were set up in Kasilov in the beginning in 1920, and we can talk more about that. But within about 8 years, by 1928, those homesteaders had set up their own phone line in the community. They had they just ran the line from homestead to homestead, you know, attaching it to trees and running it across the river flats on tripods. And it was one line with those great old-fashioned crank phones. Thank you. But everybody had to have a battery in their phone to run it. But there were great stories about the overheard conversations and
Party lines.
Yes, the feuds that would get started on the party lines and things. But they created an amazing amount of infrastructure for themselves.
This is Alan Oxier. I don't know if you folks know Alan, who's coming in. Our microphones seem to be messed up here. Hold on one second here.
Live radio.
I like using the center mic. Alan is in here to tell folks out there about how awesome public radio is and why they should support us. Do either of you listen to public radio on occasion?
Yes.
Oh, what do you think of public radio?
I appreciate its existence very much, and especially like the community calendar aspect. Use that for organizations that I'm involved with to help people, help get the word out about events we have going on. I really appreciate that.
And I as well. KDLL is my station in the car. I don't use the radio too much in the house, but when I'm in the car, I count on it. And sometimes I'll go, we live in a place that reception on anything is kind of, I'm the last living soul, I think, without a cell phone, because a cell phone won't work at my house unless you go stand in the middle of the yard. And I don't want to pay for two phones, so I don't have that, and I don't get radio very well in the house. And but I listen to it all the time in the car.
Carol, I'd like to introduce you to the second to last person who doesn't have a cell phone, Alan Oxier.
I refuse to have a cell phone.
Yeah. So I know two people who don't own cell phones.
I do have one suggestion for increasing your
coverage?
Capacity to receive the signal. If you take a bare copper wire and run it on the side of the house and into your radio, you can attach it as an antenna. And if the copper wire is facing towards our antenna transmission site, you'll increase your capacity to receive the signal. Real simple, bare copper wire.
Cool.
Yeah. Real old technology.
My kind of technology.
Yeah. Alan, we're talking this morning about history. On the Kenai Peninsula, and how important history is. Went out and lived some 1830s history on your own, didn't you?
Right. Well, first of all, I have a Bachelor of Arts degree in history, so I very much appreciate history.
Oh.
And yes, I did. I took a mountain man trip that went through the Rocky Mountains riding horse and pulling mules and camping out and living off the land as much as possible. And all of my equipment, all my clothing, everything was pre-1840. Lit fires with flint and steel and rolled our own cigarettes and that kind of thing. So, I very much appreciate history.
And somehow you became a radio station general manager and our radio station general manager.
Right, for I think 15 years, 16 years, whatever it was.
Something like that, yeah.
But I, in and amongst the different things that I have done, my career was basically instructional, educational, or public broadcasting. That includes both TV and radio side. And I ended up here at KDLL for the last few years of my career. So, yeah.
Can you imagine homesteading in, say, Kasilof in 1920?
I can imagine it, but I'm glad I didn't have to do it. One thing I found out on the mountain man trip is it's an awful lot of hard work.
It's a ton of work.
Yeah.
It's a ton of work. And the homesteading, so in 1898, homestead laws, American homestead laws, were extended to Alaska. And people, for the first time, were able to acquire anywhere from 5 acres to 160 acres of federal land if they met the prove-up requirements. And it was an incredible, from my perspective now, I think it was an incredible opportunity for the early Euro-Americans who came here. In Kasilof, there were 8 or 10 homesteads filed in the 1920s by people who were starting up fox farms. And a couple of them had been there for decades. They had come up to work for the cannery and then settled, built cabins, just basically were squatting. And I don't know what, if anything, they knew about these. They were immigrants. Some of the later ones were not immigrants. They were just Americans from other parts of the country. And I'm not sure exactly what they knew about the homestead laws at first, but it turned out that they could pick a piece of property and eventually acquire ownership. And that must have been such a remarkable thing to the primarily Scandinavian immigrants who came here because of the poverty and lack of opportunity back home in Finland or Norway or wherever they were from. And it must have been a really, even though they had to work just incredibly hard to get by on their free piece of land, it still must have felt like an incredible opportunity to them.
You know what I always wondered? My grandfather actually came from Finland at the turn of the other century. And it always occurred to me, it's like, how much different was, Alaska? And he started in Astoria, Oregon, and came to Dillingham. But how much different was all that from wherever in Finland he came from than here in 1890, you know?
That was something that came up when I was researching the book for about Andrew Berg, who was a Finnish immigrant. And apparently, this western part of the peninsula is remarkably similar in appearance and flora and fauna to Finland.
Yeah, I was thinking about, and the, the amount of work needed. I suppose the infrastructure was much less.
That's an understatement. Yeah.
But really,
none whatsoever.
Yeah, but I'm thinking about, really, how much infrastructure did they have in Finland in 1890?
Oh.
I mean, they were owned by the Russians in 1890, I'm pretty sure, weren't they?
Yeah, but they had schools and stores and...
And roads.
And, they had probably some roads.
Yeah.
okay, I guess they weren't still in the Stone Age, I suppose.
No.
Okay. I don't know anything about Europe. That's not my thing. Alan, could you tell us a little bit about our fundraiser and how people can help public radio very quickly?
You betcha. That's really why I'm here. This is our semi-annual. We do this twice a year. Go on the radio and ask folks to donate to the station and help keep us on the air. And what we're paying for when we make a donation is all of the programming that comes 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365, including local programs and including national and independent productions. So it is not cheap to run a station. That's one thing I learned as the station manager is it costs an awful lot of money on a day-to-day basis. And the most important source of funding for us, of course, is our membership, because that is the base of the funding pyramid. Again, I keep saying, when I go out asking for underwriting from commercial businesses or applying for federal grants or something, the only question they really ask is, how many members do you have? How much local support is there? It's the most important part of our funding. So make a phone call, 283-8433, or go online at kdll.org. I would like to thank Tina and Jim Conchalo, who renewed their membership, and she called all the way from Colorado to renew that membership. So if they can afford a long-distance call from Colorado, certainly our local listeners can afford a local phone call. And Sue and Krista are out there ready to take the your donation. Again, 283-8433. Also like to thank McDonald's for breakfast and Big Daddy Pizza for our lunches, which I understand Jenny is ordering right now.
Oh, excellent. Ooh. I'm glad I'm here for that.
So local businesses support us. Local members support us. Listeners support us. This is listener-supported public radio. If you're not currently a member, you owe it to yourself to become a member and support the radio station.
Well, thank you very much, Big Al.
283-8433, kdll.org.
That's right. Thanks so much. Well, we heard your story, Carol, about coming here when you were 15 and that you were distraught at the lack of phones. I did want to question you, though. Were there any boys?
There were quite a few. That was the biggest surprise for me. And it turns out you really don't need a telephone, even if you live in the wilderness.
They'll find you, huh?
They'll find you if there's few enough of the girls and quite a few of the boys. And in the late 1950s, we still had the working military base here right next to Kenai at Wildwood Station. So there was all of those young men up from the States to work at the base. And then shortly after we arrived, Swanson River oil fields came in. And suddenly the place was full of young men with pointy-toed boots that talked funny out of Oklahoma and Texas and Louisiana. So there was about 15 boys for every young woman that was here on the Kenai. And it turned out to be a lot of fun to live here.
Oh, boy. Pardon my impertinence here, but did you marry any one of those guys?
That's important.
Yeah, actually, I married a young man after I got to college. That okay. Out of Bank, so I didn't marry the local wife here, but yeah.
Oh, that's terrific. You know, when I moved here 20 years ago, the kind of the first thing I noticed was the accents. There were a lot of Okie and Texas accents here. And I didn't really understand the depth of the connection to oil and gas here, you know, before moving here. Because, you know, unless you live on the Kenai Peninsula,
You don't notice
You
it.
Think it's all the North Slope.
Yeah.
And I came here and I found out about Swanson River. I found about everything that was going on up at Nikiski and how even a lot of people who work on the slope, you know, had lived here. And they would, 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, fly back and forth. And it's like, wow, where did all these Okies come from?
I believe that Swanson River was the final impetus for statehood. People in Alaska had been working toward the idea of full statehood for Alaska since before 1920. Judge Wickersham was campaigning very much for it back in 1919. But really, by that time, kind of the gold rush was over, and Congress particularly had lost interest in Alaska, and we were just still kind of the redheaded stepchild up here. And then we got another big interest during the Second World War when they suddenly realized how important strategically Alaska was going to be for the nation. And so during the war, Alaska was very important. But that didn't really improve the chance for statehood. And they had known about the oil on the North Slope since sometime during the 1920s. They just couldn't figure out a way to get the oil out of there. But when they discovered oil here on the Kenai Peninsula, it was only 13 miles to Tidewater, where a tanker could come and get it. All of a sudden, we were real interested.
Ah,
and,
there you go.
And it didn't take even a whole year for Congress to vote Alaska in.
Huh. We had something they wanted.
That's right.
Yeah. And the people in the state said, hey, we got something you want, and stood up.
And until then, between the gold rush and the time that the oil started coming down the pipeline, the major economy of Alaska was salmon. It was the fisheries. And interestingly enough, the powers that be with the fisheries didn't want Alaska to become a state.
Yeah, we were Seattle's biggest suburb at that point,
exactly,
weren't we?
Exactly right, and they wanted to leave it that way.
Yeah. Another interesting thing about that period is that the federal government had really encouraged a homesteading movement here after the war. Again, as mm-hmm. Carol said, they recognized the strategic importance. And they built roads, and they surveyed land and made it available and made it easy for especially veterans to qualify for homesteads. But just building the roads and inviting the people wasn't enough. They're still, as people arrived here, they struggled to make a living, to get by, to do more than just get by. Without the oil boom, I suspect that the population or half the people that came to Homestead would have ended up leaving, and many of them did anyways, but that was a necessary piece of the economic puzzle for this part of Alaska to really flourish.
Do you feel like there's a parallel with today? Oil prices and low and unemployment?
Of course, but the circumstances are so different now. But of course, we still, you know, we're looking for the next boom, for the next certain economic source. But sure, you know, it's always been boom and bust from gold mining to fox farming to salmon to now oil.
And the Alaskans that have settled and made their mark here, they're not the ones that come and go. For the most part, the people that leave when the bust occurs are those who came here for the economic opportunity, and when that stopped being easy, they went back. And I've known people over the years who came and went and came and went and came and went as those smaller booms kept coming back. But for the Alaskans, many of us, I think, found the booms more economically disadvantaged because prices kept going up, particularly housing and that kind of thing. And if you your job or your economic ties didn't connect directly with whatever was creating the boom, then you weren't enjoying the increase of income to pay the increased rent and that kind of thing. So it all kind of evens out.
You know, I never thought about that. That's a lot like gentrification. All of a sudden, people are moving in, and your property tax goes up, and all of a sudden, you got to sell your house to afford it.
Yes.
Huh.
And speaking of downsides, I think it's really important for us to recognize that the Homesteading Act in Alaska, from when it was first applied in 1884 to when it ended, was really an important part of the mechanism that dispossessed here the Kenai Denaina people from their ancestral lands. And that was a trade-off that we immigrants have benefited from, and the original owners of the land have had very great difficulty recovering from.
Yeah, that's a continuation from, I think, 1492 that started.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Unfortunately. Well, we talked about that early part. So since you guys came here back then, how have things been, say, in the last 30 years, 20 years, you know, recent history? What do you see that is shaping what people are going to be talking about in 20 years?
Well, I think particularly for this area, our biggest boost has been the increase of medical care. When we came at the end of the 1950s, there was no hospital. And now we have, there was a hospital then in Seward, but there wasn't one here. There wasn't one in Homer. My mother was a nurse. And shortly after we came, she'd learned that there were nurses all around us. A lot of the soldiers, a lot of the veterans that had taken advantage of the Veterans Homestead Program and came here had the good sense to marry a nurse. And so as small as our population was then, there were 32 nurses right between Kenai, Soldotna, Kasilof, and Sterling.
Wow.
And I know that specific number because they started this Nurses Association. And everybody knew where the nurses lived. Because remember, there was no telephone. So if you had a problem, you had to go get them. So you made it your business to know. Well, today, we have a first-class hospital. And there's another one down in Homer. And it seems like once a week you hear of a new doctor or dentist that's moved into the area. And consequently, the fastest growing segment of demographic of our community growing here is people our age, because where it used to be people retired from Alaska, now they're retiring to Alaska, and they're not all snowbirds. So and a large part of that is because medical care is easily accessible to us now, and it wasn't before.
That's a good point. I never thought about that.
Yeah, that's an obvious thing now that I think about it. I didn't know that about the nurses. That is so cool. Yeah.
It is cool.
And I appreciate great healthcare we have locally now. One thing I thought of when you asked the question was in my historic reading of the Kenai Peninsula, I again and again come across stories of people who came through here. They might have been anything from miners to fishermen. People came here for a reason and stayed because they loved the area. They loved the land, the nature of the the beauty and the fishing and the hunting and the unspoiled nature of the Kenai Peninsula, going all the way back to the Finnish immigrants who may have related to this area because it was so much like Finland. But we are in danger of loving it so much that we ruin those qualities that many of us have treasured about it. Just too many people, too much population pressure on the resources. We have to be very, very careful that we don't ruin the things that that brought us here to begin with.
Well, that would be its own chapter in the history book, wouldn't it?
Absolutely.
I think the downturn in the King Salmon fishery will be a big chapter.
Yeah.
In the Kenai's history. What are the other chapters? If we were going to write the history of the Kenai, some years from now, before you shuffle off, what would some of the chapters be? The death of the king salmon. We got volcanoes. We got earthquakes. We got tsunamis. We got the Okies.
Yeah, and they all bring about change. And many of us tend to think of the negative part of change and don't recognize that we're a work in progress and that change is going to happen. I certainly agree with Catherine. We need to be a little more careful about it than we are. But I think that there's enough people who have stayed, intend to stay, whose children are here and intend to stay, that they'll want to protect that. I'm encouraged when I go to a borough assembly meeting and see that people are testifying to maintain the Andromeda Stream Act because of the fisheries, and they recognize the importance of the fisheries. We're not the only impetus of change for that, and part of it is climate, and part of it is the economy of the area. But that change is going to happen. We just have to make sure that it's responsibly done.
Mm-hmm. And do we have to be resilient enough to live through it?
Yes, exactly. And I think for the most part we are.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. But yes, there's a chapter about even, we tend to think right around here that we don't have a gold rush history. And it's true that we never had the kind of rush that they had in the Juneau area that used to have 14 pretty good-sized gold mines going on. Now they're down to 4. But we didn't have the rush that started down in Southeastern and moved into Canada and then to Fairbanks and then to Nome. So we don't have a gold rush history. But there was some, and that's how Seward got started, was bringing in supplies for first the little Sunrise and Hope, little boom that they had with their tiny little gold rush there, and then later on they started the Iditarod for that. So there'll be that gold rush, and then there was the fisheries that started, as Catherine pointed out, as the second cannery in Alaska was right on Cook Inlet. That astounded me, considering how we're talking Bristol Bay, the biggest fisheries in the world, and we're talking Kodiak and all of Southeastern. There used to be canneries all the way up from Seattle to here.
You practically
but
walk
the second
on.
One in Alaska was right here on Cook Inlet. So there was the fisheries. And then there was the military, because it wasn't just wildwood. Right after the Second World War, during the Cold War time, there was a little base over in Seward. There was one in, of course, the big base in Whittier during the war that stayed there until the mid-50s. There was one in Homer. There were military bases all over the place. So there was a military time here. And the medical history didn't begin when they built the hospital. You know, they had the pioneering doctors, and like Dr. Pollard, that came into the Kasilof area and kept up his practice of dentistry there. And the canneries brought medical doctors in, so at least there were doctors during the summertime. But now we have that going for us. It'll be interesting to see what the next one is.
Mm-hmm. You know, as I as my beard gets grayer, and you know, there's really not much more room for it to go, but I start thinking, I catch myself, because I really don't want to think this, but I think, ah, these kids today, they're screwing things up. They should do it this way. And then I think, you know what? I bet people my age have been saying that about people that age since Plato.
The beginning of time.
Yeah. And what do you think? I mean, are people today taking care of your peninsula?
Some of them are.
Uh-huh. I know. I
and
know
there
Catherine.
Again, I think it's the people who will stay, young people that will stay. And a lot of the young people don't. They go off to college someplace else, and sometimes they never come back.
You know, I left for 12 years, but I did come back to Alaska.
Yeah.
But you're right. I know plenty of people who've turned left and never turned back.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it does. In the absence of lots of good jobs, you know, this is apropos of the sort of recent oil industry decline, people kind of need to be motivated to stay here. And hopefully those will be the kind of people who value the natural resources enough to make sure that they continue to be sustained. I've always thought, not always, in recent years, I've wondered and hoped that jobs that, internet jobs, you know, jobs that don't require natural resource exploitation, but just a high-speed internet connection. I've been hoping that somehow our communities could get more into that, so that people could be here for reasons other than exploiting natural resources that will eventually be depleted, because the boom and bust cycles, I think, are not very healthy for communities.
That's absolutely true. Well, Catherine Cassidy and Carol Knutson, thank you both very much for coming in.
Sure, Jay.
And it's absolutely awesome to talk with both of you and find out about what it is you guys like to think about in the history realm here. And I hope I could have you guys on again sometime. If you guys are amenable, maybe you can bring some friends. Maybe we'll write the history book of Kenai on the air here. Who knows?